Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On Tuesday, the day after President Obama was inaugurated, the New York Times front page headline read, "Obama offers liberal vision." As Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting points out, if there was one consistent media message about the Obama inauguration ceremony, it was the idea that he was announcing a clear shift to the left. But coverage failed to provide much background on the president's actual policies, which would have challenged that impression. Much of the attention to this shift came due to Obama's comments about climate change. The inclusion of climate change was treated as a particularly big deal, given that inaugural addresses seldom dwell on policy. Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting takes a look at the New York Times piece, "Speech Gives Climate Goals Center Stage." They point out that that story and much of the media commentary on climate change failed to even mention the Keystone XL pipeline, which was recently approved by the governor of Nebraska. The Washington Post editorial came out in favor of it. A number of senators have sent the president a letter urging him to support it. But the administration has decided to push back their decision to April. And we will talk about that a little later in the show with David Sassoon, publisher of Inside Climate News, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization. And they point out that there are just a dozen reporters working for the top five papers on the environment. Also, a little later in the show, we'll be joined by Kate Shepard, staff reporter with Mother Jones. She has been reporting on the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. She's reporting from Jackson, Mississippi, which is home to Mississippi's only clinic that provides abortions. But first, we're going to take a look at the ongoing bloodshed in Syria. On Wednesday, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov officially confirmed that 77 Russian citizens fled Syria on Tuesday. 1,000 have requested Russia's help in leaving the country. According to the Associated Press, the foreign minister denied that the move was the start of a larger evacuation effort and said Russia's embassy in Syria would continue to operate normally. There are roughly 40,000 Russian citizens living in Syria. And joining us to talk about coverage of this is Fred Weir. He is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He's been there since 1998. He moved to the Soviet Union back in 86 and has lived there permanently. Fred writes for a number of outlets, including The Independent and the South China Morning Post, and he joins us from Razdori, a small village just outside of Moscow. Hi, Fred. Welcome back to the show.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for staying up late to join us. So give us an update. I noticed that earlier in the week this was getting a little bit of attention, but yesterday there were so many more stories about Russia admitting that it has helped about 77 citizens leave Syria. Can you give us an update on this?
Well, yeah. There was a mini evacuation of people who are a tiny fraction of the number of Russians living in Syria who had requested repatriation, and Russia sent two big jets to Beirut and laid on a bus convoy bringing them to Beirut to bring them back to Russia. So the question really is this the beginning of a much, much larger evacuation of tens of thousands of people we know are Russians and Russian dependents living in Syria? Or was this just a one-off thing, as the Russians are trying to convince us, where there was a group of people who were living in hot spots whose homes had been destroyed or something, who desperately wanted to leave? So it remains to be seen.
And what is the significance of this move, and why now?
Well, I think that the situation in Syria is dismal and probably getting much worse. And also, because of the geopolitical stance of the Russian government, people who are Russians possibly, are being targeted. There is some evidence that they are. And over the past 40 plus years that Russia and Syria have been close allies, thousands of Russian women have married Syrian men. And they've gone to Syria and presumably had children, raised family. It's hard to know just how many of them there are, but the best estimates say about 40,000 people. And these people now are in harm's way. And if, particularly among the rebels, there is the perception that Russians are the enemy, they may be particularly threatened. So I think this is, one interpretation that's been put on this is that the Russians are doing a dress rehearsal for an evacuation that is yet to come.
What is Russia's current position on Syria, and how do you think this will change it?
Well, the Russian position is, to be fair to them, they claim they do not support Assad. They support stability. They support the legitimate established government, and with whom they have been in contract and arrangements and relationships. And they say that the government is threatened now by a coalition of rebels who are supported from outside, and they don't necessarily take a stand one way or the other on what the Syrian people should decide, but they think that the legitimate government, as they see it, should be involved in the solution of it. So there has been a long-going tug-of-war between Russia and the West over this, because the West tends to support Syrian rebels who are aiming to overthrow the dictatorship of Bashar al-Assad, and so on. So there is this situation where Russia takes one stand and they buttress their arguments to legalities and arguments of realism, and the reality on the ground, which is Syria is spiraling into civil war. Hard to say.
We're speaking with Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. He'll be with us for just under 10 more minutes, and we're talking about the Russian government's decision to move a number of citizens, whose citizens wanted to flee Syria, and they are bringing citizens back to Syria. And we're talking about Russia's stance on Syria and then its larger interest in the Middle East and how Syria fits into Russia's foreign policy. If you have any questions for Fred about this and specifically the coverage, now would be a good time to call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. So how is this playing out in the Russian media, Fred? Because this is a major foreign policy issue for Russia today.
Well, Russians tend to support the government on this. The government's narrative is that Syria is being subverted by Islamist rebels supported by the West and by the Gulf states, and so on. And so in Russia, the general view is they're deeply concerned about the fate of their citizens and also of Syrian Christians, because Syria's Christian minority has very close relations with the Russian Orthodox Church. And so in Russia, it is a patriotic issue. It is a strong issue which tends to lend fast support to the Russian government position. I know that's not easy to express to a Western audience, but this is the state of affairs in Russia. Russians are very supportive of their government on this issue.
Why do you think that is?
For the reasons that I mentioned, that Russians think that Syria is a case where Western subversion, mm-hmm. Western-backed subversion, is aiming to overthrow a legitimate government, and a Christian minority that has strong traditional ties with the Russian Orthodox Church is being persecuted. This is what Russians think. This is what they hear because they have the a state media that doesn't exactly give a wide range or spectrum of opinion.
Do you know, are there any Russian journalists reporting from inside Syria?
There actually are quite a lot of them because Russian journalists are given preferential access, but mainly in Damascus on the side of the state, the Syrian state. So the narrative that you get tends to be, and it is a very clearly, you know, I watch the Russian media, it clearly is a very complicated situation inside Syria. There's no doubt that lots and lots of people support the Syrian government inside Syria. The Russian media covers that. They show the peaceful life of civilians in Damascus and many places under the protection of their state and so on. It's probably not false. It's just that it's a particular slice of what a larger picture would be. But yes, this is all covered in the Russian media, but it is covered from that side.
Well, we have a caller on the Russian naval base in Syria. Let's hear from Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about that base. It does have a great deal of strategic importance from the Russian perspective. Is it the case that perhaps they're reluctant to break with Assad in order not to lose the base? That's the gist of my question. And how essential is that base perhaps to the survival of the Assad regime? I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, I don't think that it's not really a base. Per se, it's a naval refueling facility in Tarsus, in on the Mediterranean coast in Syria. It's it is the only Russian naval or military facility that lies outside the former Soviet Union. So it's sort of significant in that respect, and it's also significant because it is the last or only vestige of the very thriving relationship the Soviet Union and Russia once had with Syria. But I don't think it's critical to Russia's long-term strategic survival or anything like that. It just has symbolic meaning.
And Fred, what is your read on what's to come? I mean, we're getting so many different reports. For example, the U.S. ambassador to Syria says that you can hear artillery outside Assad's office, and he believes that this is a sign that the regime is slowly starting to crumble and will eventually fall. But then when you read other reports, it says that that's not going to happen anytime soon.
Yeah. You know, I sit here just outside of Moscow, and I mostly monitor the Russian media, and it gives a clear impression that Assad is strong, he's holding on, and he's not going to crumble anytime soon. And so far, the Russian media has been right about that. So, you know, we're sort of on different sides of the divide, reading media and how they interpret things, and it's a teachable moment, I guess. But I otherwise am not in a position to say.
All right, and then you've got France, a former colonial ruler of Syria, saying that there are no signs that al-Assad is about to be overthrown.
Yes, I think the numbers suggest that Assad has pretty strong popular backing. He has the Alawite community, he has the Christian minority, and probably big sections of the more elite upper-class Sunni community as well. And some of these, As the struggle has become more sectarianized, it seems that the lines have become drawn more desperately. So it's quite possible that this civil war would go on and become a fight for the death, and that there would be no backing down on either side. And as we see, Assad maintains all the key positions of power. So probably that's right. He's not going to crumble anytime soon.
All right. Well, Fred, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you for staying up late in Russia.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you. That is Fred Weir. He is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, joining us from Razdory, a small village just outside of Moscow. And you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. It's our media roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. And now I would like to welcome Kate Shepard to the show. Kate is a staff reporter in Mother Jones Washington Bureau. She has been reporting from Jackson, Mississippi, the only clinic in the entire state offering abortions. You can find her piece along with some incredible photos. There's also a video essay there called Inside Mississippi's Last Abortion Clinic. Hi, Kate. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So on Friday, we always ask our guests to point to a piece of reporting that was done well this week. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, let's see. When my piece came out to mark the 40th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, and there were a bunch of really good pieces to speak about this. A few of them I'd note was we did a piece about the clinic in Jackson, and so did the Atavist. They have a great film and photo essay about the Jackson Clinic that's definitely worth checking out. Another good piece I thought was the Vanity Fair had an interesting piece sort of digging into the woman behind the Roe and Roe v. Wade. That was, I thought, really excellent as well.
Mm. And what did you think overall about the coverage? Because I noticed that so much of it is what we hear every year around the anniversary, that this is divisive, this is controversial, the country will never come to terms with or never find common ground on this issue. What are your thoughts on those lines that we often hear?
Well, yeah, you're right. We always hear those lines, but it's actually... Pew put out some new data this week looking at how Americans feel about this. And in reality, the people's opinions about Roe and about abortion and access to reproductive choices hasn't really changed. It's held pretty steady. A pretty steady majority of people think that women should have access to abortion. Maybe they have slightly different feelings about how much access they should have. But, you know, in general, people are supportive of that decision. And so I think we see all these headlines that are about the country being divided, but in reality, we haven't really changed that much.
Right.
We're about where we were 10, 20 years ago.
Well, and the Wall Street Journal, NBC, had a new poll and found 70% of the population supports Roe. And even Republicans for Choice had a survey that, and they basically asked, should the woman decide or should the government? And overwhelming Republicans, independents, and Democrats said the woman should decide.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it often depends on how you ask the question, right? I think that should the government decide, a lot of people who are in favor of smaller government, they don't like that phrasing either. You know, they don't like abortion. They don't like the idea that the government would decide. So, yeah, I mean, I think the politics are, you know, I don't think they've actually changed that much. I mean, what has changed is that we've seen a number of new and different ways of limiting the access to abortion at the state level. And I think that's what a lot of the coverage focused on this week. The last 2 years have seen an unprecedented number of new abortion clinic regulations or new barriers to receiving that care in the states. And so a lot of coverage looked at that.
Right.
And looked at how much harder it's getting to access that care, even if it's illegal.
And what about the people behind this? Because what I liked about your piece is that you actually profiled, for example, Dr. Willie Parker, a doctor. He lives in Washington, flies to Jackson, Mississippi once a month. You also profiled a patient, a clinic director. I mean, and the people that work in these clinics, when they leave, they look over their shoulder. I remember talking to a doctor many years ago who wore a bulletproof vest to work. And I felt like a lot of the pieces didn't really tell the real stories of the people behind this so-called controversy. What are your thoughts on that? And where did you see that reported well?
I mean, absolutely. You often hear it's two sides about a whole lot of faces, right?
Right.
But people who hate abortion and people who love abortion. And that's not that, it's not like that at all, right? I mean, people who are accessing the care, they're complicated, complex people, and they're accessing it for a number of reasons. People who provide the care, You know, they have different reasons for believing that they should be providing it. And there's also different levels of comfort. You know, I'm one doctor at the clinic in Jackson that I profile in this piece is very much doesn't want to be known. He wears a mask into the office. He doesn't want his name involved ever. He's not quoted in the story because he doesn't want to be in the press. Then you have another doctor like Dr. Pucker, who I also featured in the story, who is very much public about this. He goes out and he talks to reporters like me. He goes and talks at public events because he really believes that that's part of the challenge, right, is that we should be putting a face on these doctors and having a human connection to it and having them talk about why they do it and why they believe it's the right thing to do instead of sort of hiding and having sort of a sense of shame around providing that care. And so, in general, the coverage doesn't really dig into who those doctors are and who the patients are and who the people who work there are. In Jackson, I was really impressed by meeting the women who worked at the clinic. The doctors who provide care there fly in from out of state, but the women who work there live there. The nurses, the phlebotomists, the counselors, the clinic director—they all live in Jackson, and they're not hiding, and they're not afraid. They're very proud of the work they do there, and they're very engaged in their community. And that's what I found really impressive about being down there.
Yeah, why do you think it's so rare that we don't see the human side of this? And talk about just how powerful that is in telling that story.
You know, it's a complicated thing, right? I mean, it is a personal issue. It's, you know, most people who go into the clinics, they don't want to have a lot of attention. They don't want people to talk about it. It's often hard to get women to tell their stories about why they're there because it's still seen as something that is, you know, should be a secret or should be shameful. And so it often takes a lot to get women to talk about it. And I think that's one of the challenges in reporting on it, right? You have to invest some time in being there and getting to know the people who are there and trying to figure out a way to tell their stories, make them comfortable with having their stories told. I think that's one of the reasons we don't see more of it. And same with the people who work at these clinics, you know, they're also, you know, there's a lot of apprehension about being, you know, being public, having a public face related to the abortion issue. And so I think that it's tough to get those stories out there. But I think that we saw a lot of it this week. Another great piece of media this week that came out late last week is a film that debuted at Sundance. It was called After Tiller, and it's about the four remaining doctors who provide late-term abortions in the U.S., and it profiled the four doctors and followed them and spent a lot of time with them in their clinics and traveled with them and talked to their families. And it was a really well-done piece that also, I think, brought a really important human face to the story.
Right. And actually, that got quite a lot of media attention this week, and most of it was fairly positive.
The film's it's very well done. I really, I thought I think it's really great.
Yeah, and you can see clips of that film called After Tiller. We'll put a link at yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Kate Shepherd. She's a staff reporter with Mother Jones, and she's been reporting from a clinic in Mississippi. It's the only clinic in the entire state that provides abortions. You can find her piece along with a video, essay, and photographs called Inside Mississippi's Last Abortion Clinic at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you. This is the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. This got a lot of media attention this week. What really struck you about the attention? Did you think that some of these stories went beyond the usual, it's controversial line to really tell the stories of what women are facing across this country as access to abortion just shrinks wildly, especially in rural areas? And what really stood out for you? We'll also talk about coverage of climate change and Keystone. It's your call, and we'll be back after this.
Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco, online, KALW.org. Take part in today's conversation on the Media Roundtable. Please call 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. And let us know if you're a first-time caller. If you prefer to write rather than call, you can send an email question or comment to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on Monday, we'll have a conversation with Nick Terse about his new book, Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. He spent 10 years looking at what we still need to know about Vietnam. He says that violence against Vietnamese noncombatants was not exceptional. It was pervasive and systematic. So we'll be talking with Nick Terse on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join today's media roundtable, we're talking about coverage of the 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. We will also discuss coverage of climate change. President Obama got a lot of attention because of what he said during his inaugural address. There was a lot of attention specifically because he mentioned the words climate change. So what did you think about that coverage? Fairness and accuracy in reporting say that most media failed to really look at the background on his policies and failed to mention Keystone in a lot of the pieces about the inauguration. So what are your thoughts on this? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. We're joined by Kate Shepherd, staff reporter with Mother Jones Washington Bureau. You can find her latest piece, Inside Mississippi's Last Abortion Clinic, at yourcallradio.org. And before we move on, I just want to ask you one more question about this, Kate, because on Wednesday, Catherine Brown, a Republican state representative in New Mexico, introduced a bill that would make obtaining an abortion illegal for women who had been raped because it would be, quote, tampering with evidence. This would be a felony punishable by prison time. This is receiving national attention. And Catherine Brown is now claiming that the bill was meant to punish the rapist, not a woman seeking an abortion. When this was introduced, I thought, here we go again. Are we going to see these outrageous bills introduced on an almost biweekly basis, or these outlandish comments from politicians about women and rape? How do you think the media should deal with this? Because we saw so much of it last year.
Well, I mean, I think we should, I mean, we have to deal with it by drawing attention to it, right? A lot of these things happen and you don't get any attention until they pass. And then we say, you know, a few months later, like, oh, wow, why is that strange thing happening in the States? I can't believe that happened. This one in New Mexico, I'm not really sure what to make of it. You know, reading the bill, it sure sounds like it was intended to stop a woman from having an abortion if she's raped. You know, she then issued her statement saying that it was being misinterpreted. But if that's the case, it was a really poorly written bill to begin with because it was very unclear. But I mean, just repeatedly at the state level, a lot of things are happening that just aren't getting that much attention, right? Really, bills that have pretty dramatic influence on women's access to abortion care happen and pass, and they get very little attention at the national level. In the last 2 years, you've seen more than 100 new laws passed, and some of them got attention, but you know, a lot of them pass, and then you know, we don't really notice them at the national level. And unless you're a woman who lives in North Dakota or South Dakota or Mississippi, you maybe have no idea how hard it is to get abortion care and how much harder it's getting.
Right. And then you also have women taking to the steps of their capitals, and then that tends to get some coverage. And in some cases, because of all of the attention, the bill ultimately fails.
Well, right. Usually it's you know, casting some sunlight on it that actually causes people to come out and protest it, or you know, convince their legislators to pull the bill. It's absolutely the case that, you know, politicians respond to that outrage. And so if women are out there saying that, you know, this is they're going to draw a hard line on the issue, then it's less likely to pass.
Right.
That's what we saw in Virginia. I mean, last year we saw this big outburst over the transvaginal ultrasound bill in Virginia that was going to require women to have ultrasounds before they could have an abortion. You know, ultrasounds that doctors that are not medically necessary, that are often wouldn't have to be extremely invasive. That same bill had passed in many other states already, but when it happened in Virginia, it got a lot of attention. It got people out in the streets, and maybe because it's a little bit closer to Washington, D.C., a lot of us are covering it more, but that one had to be pulled eventually because, or amended substantially eventually because there was so much outrage over it.
And Fresh Air with Terry Gross interviewed a woman this week who had to go through an ultrasound in Texas. And she wrote an incredible article, which got a lot of attention. And if you get a chance, listen to this interview, because it's very eye-opening about what's happening on the state ground and how this is really affecting real people. That is Kate Shepherd. She's a staff reporter with Mother Jones. You can find her piece inside Mississippi's last abortion clinic. They actually just had a rally in Jackson yesterday. And Kate also covers the environment, and she's got another piece called Does Obama Mean It This Time on Climate? And that's what so many people are asking after the president made comments about climate change at his inaugural address. He said, quote, "We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations. Some may still deny the overwhelming judgment of science, but none can avoid the devastating impact of raging fires and crippling drought and more powerful storms. America cannot resist this transition. We must lead it," end quote. And also joining us now to talk about coverage of this is David Sassoon. He's the publisher of Inside Climate News. That's a nonprofit, nonpartisan news organization that focuses on these issues. And Inside Climate News also is running a piece that has found just about a dozen reporters are covering the environment for the top five newspapers in this country. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, and I'm so glad that we found your outlet, because you're all doing really great reporting. And I just want to ask you overall, fairness and accuracy in reporting points out that the front page of the New York Times on Tuesday says, "Obama offers liberal vision. We must act." And Fair points out that in so much of the coverage specifically on climate change, they don't even mention the Keystone XL pipeline. And in fact, in the New York Times main story, speech gives climate goals center stage, they didn't mention Keystone. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, we noticed that too, and we thought it was a glaring omission from the story. The Keystone is a central decision around climate change that the administration is facing. You know, on a better note, there was a very good story today in Politico. They did a profile of John Kerry, and they called him Mr. Climate, and they looked at the importance of, you know, or the meaning of what it of his position in the State Department if he is finally confirmed.
So we've got a couple different things going on with Keystone. So much is happening over the past couple of days. Nebraska Governor Dave Heineman, a Republican, has approved an alternative route through his state. A number of senators, mostly Republican but also Democrat, have sent President Obama a letter urging him to express support and basically give Keystone the green light. You've got the Washington Post editorial came out in favor of Keystone, and they also said that the Sierra Club's focus on the pipeline is distracting and time-wasting. For the first time in their history, the Sierra Club has said that it will take part in nonviolent civil disobedience at a protest in Washington next month. So there's so much going on here. Kate, what do you make of the media coverage of all of this? Also, The Atlantic has a piece believing that the president will approve the pipeline.
Well, I mean, I think it's not a surprise that so much attention is going into the pipeline. It's largely because environmental groups have focused so much attention on the pipeline. They were searching, I think, after a climate bill failed in Congress in 2009 to find something concrete to organize behind, right? I mean, then in terms of climate change, it's something that's sort of big and global and kind of in the distance, and it's about invisible emissions. It's hard to get it to be concrete, right? Cap and trade is a hard thing to get people to understand, but a pipeline is very clear. It's, you know, like something that's actually being built. It's going to transport, like, really dirty oil into the U.S. People get that, and so I think that's why environmental groups have chosen this to organize around, and it's something that Obama has a very clear say in, right? The State Department and the Obama administration gets to decide what happens here, and so they put all their efforts behind this because they see it as sort of a big test of Obama's commitment to climate change and a big test of, you know, where we're going to go on climate policy and energy policy in the next 4 years, and so that's why they put so much attention to it, and I think it's why we're seeing so much media attention to it as well.
And what are your thoughts on this, David?
I think there's something very real beyond sort of the campaign posture that the environmental groups can take on the pipeline. When you're looking at the climate issue and wanting to take action, like the president said he does, it's not enough to do energy efficiency or improve the mileage of cars or even promote renewable energy technologies. At the same time, there has to be attention to energy policy and how you decide what kinds of energy you're going to use. So if you want to address climate change, there does have to be attention to reducing the consumption of fossil fuels in very concrete ways. So I think that's why the Keystone is such a signature issue, because it taps into one of the largest pools of carbon in North America. And similarly, he's going to be facing issues, well, maybe not him, but the states are going to be looking at issues related to the export of coal to Asia or the export of natural gas to Asia and other markets. This is what the industry quite naturally wants to do, because that's where their profitability is and that's where opportunity is. It's colliding with the need to assure environmental security by addressing climate change.
Well, and this is why the reporting is so important, and why the piece that one of your colleagues wrote was disturbing, about the fact that there are about a dozen reporters covering the environment at the top five U.S. newspapers. And we've done shows just about the facts regarding Keystone. You know, there are a lot of claims about jobs. A number of unions support this pipeline. There's a lot of fact and fiction about how much oil would actually be shipped overseas and how much would stay here. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of facts and fiction about how this would really affect the economy. So what are your thoughts about just about the truth about Keystone?
Well, there is a lot of confusion about what the facts are. I think that because of the lack of resources that the media has now, with very few environment reporters looking at these issues through an environmental lens, the public is not understanding what's happening. And, I think that much of the oil that would come to this country is really not necessarily for the benefit, of energy security or oil prices. A lot of it might be exported. And even the TransCanada admits that if the oil gets here, prices will go up for Americans. So there's a lot of rhetoric, and, we need more reporters. The industry is suffering over the last, 5 years with newspapers closing, reporters getting fired. So it's a difficult situation.
And this is, again, a 1,700-mile, $7 billion pipeline. The administration has pushed back its decision until April. Kate, what are your thoughts on that? And what about the Atlantic's piece saying that they believe the president is going to support and give it the green light?
Well, I think one thing that's interesting about this pipeline is that the government has approved many, many pipelines before. We have thousands of miles of pipelines in this country already. I mean, this one's important because it's very big and it's very long, and it's coming from the tar sands, which is, a particularly dirty kind of oil. But I think the fact that this decision has been pushed back and that it's been subject to more scrutiny and that Nebraska had to create a new route, that's pretty significant in and of itself, that there's been much more attention to it than any other pipeline, I think, ever, arguably. So that's notable. Will Obama approve it? There's a lot of people guessing one way or another. It's really hard to say right at this point. I think maybe 3 months ago I thought for sure he probably would have approved it, but now after seeing some of their continued delay of it and looking at some of Obama's positioning on climate in the last few weeks, I'm thinking that maybe they'd be less likely to back it. But it is hard to know what's going on inside Obama's head, and it'll also be really significant what happens when Kerry is in charge over at the State Department, because the State Department does play a pretty, the foremost role in deciding whether this is going to be approved. So whether Kerry could have some influence on whether or not it gets the green light is going to be interesting to watch.
That is Kate Shepard. She's a staff reporter in Mother Jones Washington Bureau. You can find her latest piece, Does Obama Mean It This Time, on climate at yourcallradio.org. David Sassoon is publisher of Inside Climate News, a nonprofit, nonpartisan news outlet that covers these issues. His colleague Maria Gallucci has a piece, John Kerry Says He'll Control Keystone XL Review as Secretary of State. Climate change is among the, quote, life-threatening issues, according to John Kerry, that define U.S. foreign policy. He told this to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee yesterday. And if you'd like to join us, what are your thoughts on coverage of these very important issues? And if you have any thoughts overall about how the media covered President Obama's inaugural address, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Ken in San Francisco. Hi, Ken. Welcome to the show. Hello, Ken. Did we lose Ken? Ken said he thought the speech was just lip service and that there was no mention of fracking. It makes me laugh because, Kate, just so many environmentalists were just overjoyed that the president actually mentioned the word climate change. I can't even imagine him ever talking about fracking in a speech like this.
Yeah, I mean, the inaugural speeches are not really one for specifics, right? You're not proposing policy in the inaugural speech. You're just sort of laying out a sort of grand vision without having to back it up with actual policy. You know, enviros were absolutely very happy that he mentioned it. I think they're still kind of a little cautious about whether he's actually going to do anything about it. He's been pretty good at mentioning it throughout the last 4 years, but he hasn't been as good about putting the political weight behind making something actually happen. So I think there's some, people are glad he mentioned it, but it's kind of cautious optimism.
Well, and so many of our listeners care about fracking. One of your latest pieces is Fracking Wastewater Threatens to Drown Ohio. You cited a new study in the journal Water Resources Research. Can you just give us an overview of what they found?
So this research was looking at the amount of wastewater created by natural gas extraction, and it was comparing more conventional means of extracting natural gas to fracking, which is, it's the short term for hydraulic fracturing, which is, a method of extracting natural gas from shale rock. The study basically found that fracking uses less water per unit of gas that you extract, but that since we're doing so much more fracking than we were before and extracting so much more gas than we were before, it's more than a 500% increase. We're creating much more wastewater overall. And right now, Pennsylvania is sort of ground zero for where all this development's happening, and they're creating a lot more water than they can dispose of in their state, and so they're sending a lot of it to Ohio, which is actually it's a very interesting question because of the interstate commerce laws, Ohio can't do that much to stop them. They can create better laws or tighter regulations around disposal of that water in Ohio, but they can't stop it from coming in, point blank. So basically, they're trying to figure out what to do with all this wastewater and where will it go.
These are astonishing numbers. You report that because of fracking, gas extraction is up 570% since 2004 in the Marcellus Shale region, which means that there's a lot more wastewater overall to deal with. And I also just want to give kudos. I don't remember the name of the reporter, but The Nation had an amazing piece a couple weeks ago about how fracking is affecting our food supply. I mean, it was an incredible lengthy piece. So I'll put a link on our website right after the show. Let's hear next from Kevin in Felton. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call. I also found it bizarre that all the president has to do is make a few rhetorical remarks, and all these reporters and commentators run around all excited because he finally mentions climate change, as if we haven't watched him for the last 4 years. I find it amazing. And the other comment I wanted to make was that for decades I've been hearing how we were threatened by the fact that our petroleum and gas resources were coming from outside the United States. We're going to lose our sovereignty, all this. And suddenly the petro industry is getting ready to export compressed natural gas and oil out of the United States. So we would suddenly become a net exporter, it sounds like. And this new fact doesn't seem to even cause a ripple.
Hmm. Well, yeah, it's a good point. And I'll get David to respond. And also to that point, David, we have an email from Stephen in San Rafael. He says, a key question I have not heard an answer to is, if the pipeline is not built, will the oil still be extracted and sent somewhere else?
That's a good question. And most people, a lot of people say that, oh, it'll just go to China. But actually, that's not true. If the pipeline is not built, that oil is going to stay landlocked, and it's going the development of it is going to be severely hampered. You have to remember that Canada, their own citizens, will not allow a pipeline to be built in their own country to take the oil to the Pacific, which is the nearest place to get the oil out of Canada to world markets. So they're looking at the United States to do the work that their own citizens will not allow them to do. So, you know, I think the industry is trying to figure out how to get the oil out. They're using rail. They're reversing existing pipeline flows. They're doing whatever they can because there's immense profits in it. But the pipeline would be one of the most important things that would free this oil into world markets. And it's in the hands of the United States right now.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Stephen, and thank you for the call, Kevin. Let's hear next from Raul in Novato. Hi, Raul.
Yes, on the same note as the words of where is it going and who's going to get it. Presently, they are expanding the Panama Canal to where we'll be able to accommodate huge tankers that at present time have to go around the long way. So I don't know why the environmentalists are not conscious of this. It's not that big a world, but it's happening right now, and that's where the oil is going, to China and India. And it's not. And we're just letting it go through, and we're going to suffer all the environmental damage and everything else that goes along with it. But it's never going to decrease the cost of fuel, and it probably shouldn't. So anyway, that's my comment, and I hope you sometime will go down to Panama and check it out.
Well, it's fascinating. I have not been following this, but we just found a couple links about this. David, do you know much about this? We just found a link at an industry, looks like industry, website about business, and it says that nothing so revolutionary in its effect on the global supply chain as the opening of the Panama Canal has happened since railroads replaced overland trails.
You know, I'm not up to speed on the Panama Canal, but I think the larger issue is that what the industry wants to do is create a single global market at the best price possible, and the issue with the pipeline and with the tar sands is that it will release a supply glut so that the prices will go up. Canadian oil is selling at a very big discount, as they call it, to world prices. And whether it's the Panama Canal or a pipeline or whatever, their goal is to create a single global market at the best price possible.
Well, and Raul, I just found a piece called Canal Expansion Raises Expectations and Questions from the New York Times last February. It says the port is overseeing $3 billion in updates, many of which are being completed in anticipation of the 2014 debut of the expanded Panama Canal, and they are breaking records in terms of ships to port, 8,073 in 2011 alone. So really interesting. We'll take a look at that and maybe do a show. I also wanted to ask you both just about the overall state of environmental reporting. And David, one of your colleagues had a piece saying that there are just about a dozen reporters covering these very important issues at five of the top newspapers. What are your thoughts on that? And what does that mean for, you know, when we try to get facts out about things like Keystone XL?
Yeah, I think it's a crisis within the journalism crisis. I mean, we know that, the industry is suffering. A lot of newspapers closing, tens of thousands of journalists out of work. I think it's a danger to our country. And within that crisis, there is the crisis among the environment desks. They're being closed. There aren't very many environment reporters left. And, you know, we also did a story. We broke the story about the fact that the New York Times is dismantling its environment desk.
Right.
They said it's not going to affect our coverage, but they're reassigning the reporters. It could work, but they are eliminating the position of environment editor and deputy environment editor. So in the newsroom, reporting to the managing editors, you are not going to have an environment editor and a deputy. And the reporters who work for other editors are going to be rewarded for covering the beats of those editors. So it's, you know, it's symbolic, the Times move, and it's very important. And they had the biggest newsroom of environment reporters in the country.
Well, and so there's a big gap that's going to be filled. I mean, Mother Jones has excellent environmental reporting. And then you've got your publication, Inside Climate News. You've got Grist. There are a lot of smaller online publications. So what role do you think they're going to play? And can you just, in our remaining minute, tell us a little bit about Inside Climate News and how you're funded?
Sure. We are seven people. So we are as big an operation as any newspaper in the country now.
Hmm.
And we don't cover the environment as a whole. We are focused on climate and energy issues. And we get funding from philanthropic foundations, and we distribute our news with partners, Bloomberg, McClatchy, Associated Press, The Guardian. So it's not just our platform. We're helping the bigger outlets cover the issue in the depth that they are not doing. Our plan is to grow. We want to be 20 people in the next couple of years. We think the issue deserves it. We think it's the story of the century. How a global economic system is going to transform itself. There's fossil fuel prosperity, there's energy security, those are real things.
Well,
but there's also environmental security and the peril that comes with climate change.
It's a huge issue of our time, and we're glad you're both there. We'll definitely bring you back on future shows. David Sassoon, publisher of Inside Climate News, a nonprofit, nonpartisan that covers these very important issues, and Kate Shepard is a staff reporter with Mother Jones Washington Bureau. Thank you both for joining us, and thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Here's what's coming up on Monday. What does the U.S. invasion of Vietnam reveal about the U.S. military's conduct in today's war zones? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with Nick Terse, author of Kill Anything That Moves, The Real American War in Vietnam. He argues that violence against Vietnamese noncombatants was not exceptional. It was pervasive and systematic. 30,000 books have been written about Vietnam, but what do we still need to know about that war? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you.